Welcome to Harlow on Healthcare. I'm David Harlow, and I invite you to join me by my virtual hearth as I sit down with healthcare leaders to discuss building the future of healthcare. Today, my guest is Mickey Tripathi. Mickey is a pioneer in healthcare IT interoperability and is active in the industry at a local and national level, including membership on the board of directors of HL7, the Sequoia Project, the Commonwealth Health Alliance, the Karen Alliance, and the HL7 Fire Foundation. He's also the project manager of the Argonaut Project, an industry collaboration to accelerate adoption of fire. He's former CEO of the Mass eHealth Collaborative and recently joined Arcadia as Chief Alliance Officer. Welcome, Mickey, and thanks for joining us.
Hey, David. Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
Certainly. So, Mickey, could you give us a thumbnail sketch of your role at Arcadia, and then we'll sort of roll into where we are with fire?
Yeah, we'd love to. So, at Arcadia, as the Chief Alliance Officer, I am responsible for a couple of different things. One is thinking about the strategic relationships that Arcadia might be interested in forging in the market. So we obviously have sales. Every company has sales. And then there are, you know, partnerships, other types of alliances, mergers and acquisitions, other types of relationships with companies that are, you know, a little bit more about the longer term and about, you know, sort of building the overall strategy rather than, you know, raising money in any particular year or sales in any particular year. So I'm focused on that, which is, you know, sort of the strategic partnership angle, as well as mergers and acquisitions and developing that pipeline. And the second thing that I'm involved in, which is somewhat related and is a little bit of a legacy of things that I've been involved in for, you know, for a number of years, is, you know, sort of the ongoing participation and contribution to the national level efforts like HL7, Commonwealth, Sequoia Project, Karen. And I, you know, maintain my presence there and try to be a source for the kind of information that that Arcadia is, you know, getting on the ground in terms of helping to inform that national conversation, as well as helping Arcadia grow in the ways that are more aligned, or, you know, as most effectively aligned with what's going on at the national level.
And Arcadia's focus to date has been in what, as it relates to this work?
Yeah, Arcadia is a population health management technology. So focused on technology solutions in services, but mostly technology solutions for customers engaged in value-based care and improving through care management and risk-based contracting in general. So we have a technology that covers the span of ingestion of data, curation of data, both clinical and claims data, and then providing applications that frontline care managers and anyone involved in value-based care can use to improve the management of patient populations to drive better value, higher quality, lower cost, and hopefully the combination of both of those, higher quality and lower cost.
Right. So, you know, the current iteration of the rules out of ONC are touching now for the first time, I think, on payers as well as providers. I wonder if you can speak to that, sort of the interoperability requirements that bring everybody under this big tent. Are we ready for that? Are payers ready for that? What's the ramp up going to look like to actually making good use of data coming through these interoperable connections?
Yeah, sure. So, and I think it's incredibly important. The pulling the payers in general as, you know, sort of a part of the value chain under this umbrella of standards-based interoperability and patient access. Up until now, as many of your listeners and certainly you know, when we started with meaningful use and started down this path of focusing first on laying our foundation of electronic health records that would allow electronic documentation and smart analytics in the hands of providers, and then started to turn the attention to interoperability and being able to have, you know, interoperability. And that was primarily focused on provider-to-provider interoperability and patient access. So we had, you know, view, download, transmit, which were requirements in meaningful use for patients to be able to do that with their data. And that got instantiated in the market mostly as patient portals and the ability to, for a patient to be able to go to their portal, the portal that their provider provided to them through whichever EHR vendor they had, and the ability for them to be able to download a continuity of care document, which is a XML-based document that has structured data in it that that, you know, sort of contained the what was then called the common clinical data set and is now called the USCDI. But basically, you know, a summary of their information.
That led on the from the patient perspective to what some patients call portalitis, the need to log into a million different portals if you have a complex medical history and situation, and the patient became the HIE, so to speak. Right. Do you see solutions to that problem in the marketplace today?
Not fully yet. There are certainly some early ventures that are, trying to get at that. But, if you take, sort of right now, at least the paradigmatic example of this next wave is, the Apple Health Record. Deploying the Fire API, but that actually, because that's based on OAuth type of paradigm, which I'll have to describe in a second, that still doesn't allow you to leapfrog over the need to have individual credentials at all of your providers of care. It just does that in a more convenient way, and you only have to do it one time. So if you have your Apple Health Record, and let's say you have six provider organizations, you actually have to go and register for a patient portal account at each of those six providers. And then when you're in your Apple Health Record, you actually will have to enter, for that first initiation, your username and password for each of those six. After that, you don't have to. It maintains that link and, it allows you to do it. And it's, very similar. Most people are very familiar with how, for example, if you're going to access HBO and you have cable, you get onto HBO Go, now called HBO Max, and it asks you what's your cable. Do you have a cable provider? Yes, I have Verizon, Fios. And then you enter your Verizon Fios username and password. Same thing, but now you still have to remember that. So it's a little more convenient. We've taken one step down the path, but because we don't have a single trusted source of credentials, we still haven't been able to jump ahead on at least on that. Even as great as the Apple Health Record capability is, because it does offer a lot of convenience and the ability to be able to bring data together in a much better way for a patient than we had in the past.
Right. So you started to talk about OAuth. Maybe say a little bit more about that and, what's sort of the next level in terms of a shared patient credential, and maybe also, what's the next level in terms of a shared provider or payer sort of authentication? It's not just on the patient end that we have concerns about those.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's, that's really an ecosystem issue that's, that's really an artifact, or it's a symptom of the fragmentation in the healthcare payment system. It's that fragmentation that contributes to that problem, or that creates and continues to exacerbate that problem. It's because no one trusts anyone else. And I don't mean that in a, I don't mean that in a derogatory way, although there are elements of that too, but I mean it just sort of in a basic governance, IT governance, network governance, authentication perspective. You can imagine a world where, let's say, every patient had an account with the federal government, let's say, Medicare or Medicaid. From the minute you're born, you get a Medicare ID and you get a credential, and that's something you carry with you for the rest of your life. You can imagine a world that says, oh, okay, well, everyone's going to trust an API that the federal government exposes and is able to, sort of adjudicate. So that every time I go into a provider portal, let's say, or my payer portal, it'll just like HBO Go sends me off to Verizon, it sends me off to the, to the CMS website, and I enter my, and I just have one credential, and that scales, right? So that's one model. I'm not, saying that, the federal government should do this, but I'm just suggesting that that could be one model.
One approach, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you might imagine that, like in Massachusetts, for example, where both you and I are sitting, Blue Cross Blue Shield, which is 50% of the commercial market here. What if Mass General and the Beth Israel and, and all the hospitals trusted my member ID from Blue Cross, and we did it that way? You can imagine those kinds of things developing, but because we have so much fragmentation, it's like, well, but that wouldn't work in other states, and and some providers aren't Blue Cross, and anyway, so you start to get into those problems where the whole thing kind of breaks down. So that's that's a big part of the challenge, and that's not a technology issue. That's that's a governance issue, and sort of a business convention issue that we need to sort of get more traction on over time. But getting back to a second to just what we were talking about recently, which is sort of the payers' involvement in this, and maybe this is what sort of breaks a little bit of that logjam too, is that up until now, up until the most recent rules that that were issued with the CMS interoperability rule, the meaningful use momentum just kept moving forward within a particular paradigm, which is provider to provider exchange and provider to patient access, and just moving forward in that paradigm. And the most recent rules, that came out, had a couple of things that broke that open a little bit. I mean, one is information blocking, which kind of opens up, sort of a pathway for it a little bit more by tearing down as many, or by at least exposing more of the barriers that have prevented more of that flow in that pipe, right, in the provider-to-provider and provider-to-patient pipe. But then the CMS interoperability rule comes along and says, oh, by the way, all that stuff that we've been saying, providers have to do, surprise, all of you as payers have to do that too. Because turns out you deal with the same people and you haven't been, as good as you should be in terms of making that information available and not having, portalitis for patients who, in Massachusetts, there's something like 20% churn of patients across insurers every single year. So you have the same phenomenon as patients jumping across providers, patients are jumping across payers, and they have the same issues. So I think that's, really hugely important for a couple of reasons. One is it starts to put under the same umbrella that, okay, we're going to have this new paradigm of data access through APIs, through modern convention APIs, and everyone has to kind of follow the same specifications on that and the same basic sort of spirit of that, which is whether you're a provider, whether you're a payer, you have to make the data available that you have for a patient and expose that as a FHIR API that meets the same specification. And then hopefully that will create a market ecosystem that starts to develop innovative ways that people can start to do that.
Right. If you're just tuning in, this is Harlow on Healthcare, coming to you on Healthcare Now Radio. My guest today is Mickey Tripathi of Arcadia. So in terms of interoperability, in terms of payers, in terms of providers, how does the current trend inform the availability of data to patients? How does these trends inform the availability of data to, across the provider and payer ecosystem? Given the fact that we're just looking at, regs that came out relatively recently in the scheme of things, how long before we have an effect in the marketplace as a result of these changes?
Yeah, so it's going to be a little while. It's, sort of a hurry up and wait kind of thing, right? Where, everyone gets really excited, including me, gets really excited when the final rules are released. It's like, there it is. All right, we're going to have this FHIR world finally. And then you see the timelines. It's like, the EHR vendors have 2 years before they have to implement a FHIR API.
Right.
Payers have, I think, until January 1st, before they do the patient access API, January 1st of 2021. And that easily could get pushed, right? I mean, with all of the issues related to the pandemic, perhaps that'll get delayed further. So it's going to be a little while before all of this really becomes, firmly grounded in the market. But that said, I think that just to be fair, it isn't as if you can just snap your fingers and make all of that available overnight either. There's a fair amount of technical work to do, workflow work to do to make sure that it's actually implemented and done right. So, so I think it's appropriate to have a certain period of time where you tell people this is what you need to do, and now here's what the ramp is going to be before you actually have to show that you're doing it in the market. But, as we think about what does that mean for the future of interoperability, I find it hard to predict exactly, because what we're doing is we're starting to open up more and more pathways in the hopes that the market will take it over and do creative and innovative things that at least my imagination, sort of limits me from really, sort of fully understanding how that's all going to unfold. So what does that mean? I mean, one path is, as you would, suggested earlier, the patient as the HIE. So the patient as the conduit, where the patient, so if they have got their Apple health record, and hopefully the Commons Project or, another organization will make the Android sort of parallel to that, so that I'm able to get my clinical data into my control on, through my mobile device or however, that gets substantiated, but I'm able to have that in my control. I bring it together and it's curated for me so that I don't have to do a whole lot of work. So that, the data from the different providers actually comes in and, all right, the labs match and the meds match and all of that. Because if the patient has to do any work, then forget it, right? This is just not really going to work real well. But if the patient has to do very little work, I can bring that together. But now you can imagine, because the payers have to make this data available through the same specification that the providers are required to, now the Apple Health Record, you should be able to start to see, in theory, you should, maybe it's a year from now, I don't know Apple's exact roadmap, but if the January 1st timeline holds for a payer to make, for payers to make this Spire API available to patients. You can imagine a year from now, you open up your Apple Health record, and not only does it say, here are your providers, but it also says, oh, you can, if you have data at Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts, click here. If you have data at Harvard Pilgrim, click here. If you have data at Aetna, click here. And in the same way that you're able to get your records from, you know, Mass General Hospital, you can click through and get your claims data now from, you know, from all of that. So it enriches the amount of data that you have in your control at that point, and also then starts to make that a more interesting sort of mini repository of information that apps that you download onto your iPhone or onto your Google Pixel could then be able to do more creative things, you know, for you, because now I've got not only claims data, but clinical data, where clinical data is deep in many cases, but not very broad. And the claims data is kind of the opposite. It's nice and broad, but it's not very deep. So the combination of those two things, I think, could lead to lots of really creative apps in the future.
So I see the value of that for the engaged patient, right? Yep. And I guess I'm wondering, in the, you know, behind the veil, so to speak, in the hallways of the provider and payer organizations, what are the uses that you envision all this shared data being put to?
So just to keep going down the patient track for a second, and then maybe I'll jump over to the provider and provider payer. You know, we tend to think of, you know, healthcare, you know, right now, I think, it, you know, is between, you know, things that are the patient and self-care, and when they go into our, you know, our treatment system. Right. So either patients are like kind of at home doing their own thing, whatever it is they're doing, or they're sick and they're in a healthcare provider setting. And that's it. And there's nothing in the middle. Right. but increasingly, I think that we're going to start to see more and more of these kinds of apps that actually come into the middle. And they're not providers, but they're not you yourself. They're about your being able, because you've got the data, you're being able to use apps effectively to be able to manage things and have a greater, you know, sort of set of levers over things that you can that you can manage than you did before. So whether you're, you know, if you've got any type of, you know, specific condition, those apps that get developed like Tidepool for diabetics or, you know, whatever it is, being able to help you better manage your care, whether it's being able to help you manage in a self-care kind of way or get better knowledge or connect you up to things that you would have difficulty connecting up to on your own because it's so fragmented. So Citizen, for example, is a company that connects patients, cancer patients, with clinical trials. Sure. So you can imagine the desperation of people who are really, really sick and really are just searching for whatever they can get when they're in that condition, and the frustration of being able to do that. You could have, you know, something like that, be able to help step in and help you connect you with those right places in a way that you're not able to right now. So I can see, you know, that pathway helping you about more and more down the patient side. With provider to provider and provider to payer, it's really kind of an interesting question right now, because one of the things that is, you know, a little bit of the between the lines, you know, fine print of the rules is that what the rules say specifically is that payers and providers have to make available a FHIR API for patients to be able to access the USCDI, that set of data, the common set of data. Mm-hmm. And patients need to be able to access that through that same type of specification from their payers or their providers. That's all it says. That's all it requires. It doesn't require that I expose a FHIR API if I'm a provider. It doesn't say that I have to make that FHIR API available to the payer. It doesn't, and conversely, it doesn't say to the payers, you're required to make a FHIR API available to a provider so that they can see the claims on the patient so that they can provide better care to understand where has the patient been that I have no visibility into, right? That it doesn't require either of those things. And also there's the concept of bulk data, which is, you know, sort of an extrapolation of the FHIR API to multiple patients. So a roster of patients, you can imagine the value of that. If I be able to say, well, you know, I could get through like an Apple Health Record type API, I can get one patient at a time. But if I'm a care manager, accountable care organization, or I'm a payer, or a provider going the other way, I might want to say to Blue Cross, hey, here are the, you know, 358 patients who I have who are Blue Cross members. Here's the list. I would love through a bulk FHIR API to be able to get the claims data on those patients so I can better manage them, so that I can tell which ones actually got their foot exams because they haven't shown up and I don't know, but you know, because you got the claim for it. So, and vice versa, right? Plans would love to be able to say, I'd like to get that set of data for these 1,000 patients, not just one patient. And so those are all requirements that are in there from a technical perspective, but they don't say that anyone has to use them. So the interesting question now going forward is, if you're a payer and you're looking at this and you're thinking, God, this is going to be great. I'm going to be able to have a bulk API to be able to get FHIR APIs enabled for a roster of patients from all those providers using a standard API, and no more chart chasing, no more, nurses and other professionals going into individual EHRs and trying to download data or getting all these faxes from patients and do it through these standardized APIs. Well, there's nothing in any of the rules that actually says that providers or EHR vendors have to do that. So that's right. The interesting thing, right? We're looking at this now, and it's like, this all is great hope and expectation because the capabilities are there. But one of the things that we've discovered with meaningful use was, until you take that final step and tell people, oh, by the way, you actually have to use these things in these ways.
Right. Yeah, I'm sorry. From the very beginning, when we never really got to interoperability, and we're just sort of getting there, sort of approaching that for similar reasons. The other thing that occurs to me as you're talking about this is that one of the issues that may, restrict this kind of sharing is the way in which the lines have been blurred between providers and payers. I mean, a lot of payers now do a lot of, provider-y things, and a lot of providers do a lot of payer-y things, and there's perhaps less interest in sharing information.
For competitive reasons, you mean?
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
if there's some sort of value based arrangement, if knowledge is power, then not sharing some of that data will be in the financial interest of either the payer or the provider, right?
Right. There could be, for sure. And the other side of that is that you could have more patients at the end of the day who are actually able to get, more of that information because they're in those arrangements that make that data available better, right? So it's a little bit of a, looking at it from the patient side, it's unclear, net, does that end up making us better, making a patient better or worse? If a system is better, if a system is bigger, then, I, as the patient in that system, more and more of my data will be there. Like, I get all my care at Harvard Vanguard, so all my primary care physicians and specialists are in the same place, and I've voted with my feet. In part, probably because the interoperability wasn't going to solve the problem for me.
right.
But there's also the negative side of that, right? There's a negative side of monopoly and all of that. So there's certainly, both sides of that. But I think, one of the things for us to separate out too is that, the information blocking rule, which is an important vector in this that cuts across all of this, where the information blocking rule does say that, well, no, provider to provider, you do have to exchange the information. Right. So, that's one of the subtleties I was trying to draw out is that these rules about FHIR, they are there and they say, well, you have to make the data available to patients via FHIR, but you don't have to make it available to anyone else via FHIR. You actually don't have to, but you do. But then the information blocking rule though comes along and says, oh, by the way, you do have to make the data available, except for if you fit into one of the six exceptions. But the thing is, you don't necessarily have to make it available as FHIR. So you could, for example, those two organizations you were just talking about, let's say they vertically integrated, so now they're both payer providers and they both have maybe more competitive interest in keeping the data. The information blocking rule comes along and says, no, you absolutely are required by law to share the information. You just don't necessarily have to share it as a FHIR API. And that's where you get into the weird intricacies of how is this actually going to unfold, right? Because the hopeful model is that everyone keeps moving forward with FHIR because that's an easier way to do it, and it makes better, richer data available, and it's got more, much more future, extendability for lots of more use cases. And so that would be the right thing to do for those use cases. But providers, organizations right now share over networks that are already built. They share CCDAs over networks that are already built, and they don't want to tear down things that they feel are working. And so the information blocking rule, you could imagine a provider coming along and saying to another provider, or a payer, this is where I'm seeing it a little bit more. Payers, there are a lot of payers who are making an assumption that, oh, well, providers are going to have to build these FHIR APIs and make those available to patients. Well, they'll make those available to us too. They have to by the information blocking rule. And it's like, no, read the information blocking rule. It does not say that. It says that a provider could say to you, no, I'm going to take the content and manner exception, which is that I actually don't have a FHIR API that I make available to payers or to providers. I only have FHIR APIs that I make available to patients. So I'm happy to give you a CCDA. Or by the way, why don't you just join Commonwealth or Care Quality? Then you'll get right. all the things you want. But I'm not required to make a FHIR API available to you. So then the payers are back in the existing world, actually, because mm-hmm. they can get CCDAs now. They just don't like them.
Right.
So that's a little bit of the nuance here that we're going to have to see whether there's going to have to be more regulatory, sort of teeth to actually get us just to that final closing of the loop that says, you know what, you have to do it all via FHIR.
Right. Well, there's certainly opportunity for more. So, Mickey, to wrap things up, let me ask, if you were to wake up tomorrow and find yourself 5 years in the future, what's one thing in healthcare that you would hope or maybe even expect to find has drastically changed?
What I hope will change is leaving aside this question of standards and FHIR and CCDAs and all of that, is that that at the core of this, we've changed the culture a little bit, because I think that's really the issue here, isn't it? It isn't about a FHIR API. It's, what the FHIR API will hopefully get us more toward, because it's a better enabler of a different kind of culture about information sharing in healthcare and the ability of actors, whether it's payers or providers or patients, to be able to say, we're not going to compete on that level anymore, right? The data should just be the data and should be made available. And there's more of a culture of that, like we see, somewhat in other sectors. I mean, other sectors have their own proprietary competitive things too, so I don't want to pretend that there's magic there. But if it gets us a little bit further toward, that kind of culture, then FHIR will be a great vehicle for enabling that. That's all a cultural thing, I think. And that would be my hope, is that we have more of that culture, 4 or 5 years from now.
Well, great. That's a good insight and a worthy hope for the future. Thanks for joining me, Mickey.
Thank you, David. Enjoyed it, as always.
You have been listening to Harlow on Healthcare. Join us at healthcarenowradio.com. Let's continue the conversation on building the future of healthcare together at #HarlowOnHC. I'm David Harlow, keeping the FHIR going and holding a seat open for you. Until next time.